Managing Conflict with Dr. William Summers. I'm Peggy Conrad, the Vice President of Publication here at AHA Process, and I really thank all of you for joining us today. We know how busy you are at this time of year particularly, and it is our hope that this teleseminar will provide you new understanding and effective strategies for managing conflict that you can immediately use in your workplace. That will save you a lot of time, lots more than the hour you are spending on this call today. Before I introduce you to Dr. Summers, let me go over how this teleseminar will work. With a large quantity of people on the call, we are going ahead and muting the phone lines for all participants so that you won't have to, and then we can all hear clearly and, you know, have a good call. Some of you have emailed questions in already. So, Justin, let's keep going. Some of you have emailed questions in already. And during the teleseminar, any question you think of during the call, please, we invite you to email them in at any time to questions@ahaprocess.com. That's questions@ahaprocess.com. And we will be answering as many of those as we can during the call. So, Justin, if you haven't already, why don't you go ahead and mute the participants?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. And now let me introduce our presenter today. Dr. William Summers of Austin, Texas, is currently a part-time principal at an alternative school in Minneapolis called the Learning Alternative Center in Springdale Park outside of Minneapolis. And he also does leadership coaching for the Minneapolis School District. He's a coach, a consultant, and an author in the larger scale. He's a former director of leadership and organizational development for Manor ISD in Texas, former executive director for curriculum and professional learning in Minneapolis Public Schools, and been in the schools as an administrator for more than 30 years. In addition, he serves as an adjunct faculty member at Texas State University, Hamline University, University of St. Thomas, St. Mary's University, Union Institute, and Capella University. Some of you may know Dr. Summers' National Staff Development Council conferences, where he has been a presenter for the last 12 years. He also served on the NSDC board for them and was past president of the council and continues to work for NSDC as a senior consultant. Bill has, may I call you Bill, Dr. Summers?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. He has co-authored 6 books, one of them, Living on a Tightrope, Survival Handbook for Principals. This is the book he wrote with Ruby Payne and we'll be speaking from today. And by the way, all teleseminar participants will qualify for a special tightrope thank you offer at the end of this call today. Other books he co-authored are titled Becoming a Successful Principal, How to Ride the Wave of Change Without Drowning, Reflective Practice to Improve Schools, A Trainer's Companion, Energizing Staff Development Using Video Clips, and Leading Professional Learning Communities. Lastly, I just learned this week, he has 2 more books in press coming out later this year called Principal's Field Manual and Trainer's Companion for Habits of Mind. In summary, in addition to writing many articles regarding coaching, assessment, and reflective thinking, Dr. Summers also does training in reflective practice, leadership, organizational development, conflict management, poverty, thinking skills, brain research, and classroom management. Dr. Summers is a practitioner who integrates theory into the learning opportunities he facilitates. So, Dr. Summers, we are really delighted to have you with us today, and let me offer you the floor.
Well, thank you. Sounds like with that introduction, what else can I say? Goodbye, thanks for the call. let me give you the short version. I'm basically a principal of over 35 years, and that's one of the reasons I got involved with how do you do conflict. Not that anybody listening has conflict in their school or in their staff, but it seems to me that that takes a lot of our time. Matter of fact, when he was in junior high school, asked me what I did for a living, and I said, "Well, I'm a principal." He says, "Well, I know that, but what do you do all day?" And I thought I didn't know what to say. And after about a minute, I said, I go to meetings and I solve conflicts. And as I thought about that, that's probably about 80% of what the principal does. Let me start with kind of an opening line that what I've tried to do as a principal practitioner, because that's really how I see it. Someone told me that as a principal, you should never forget what it's like to be a teacher. And as a teacher, you should never forget what it's like to be a student. And I think that's pretty doggone good advice, as a matter of fact. So about 15 years ago, when it seemed like all I was doing was gnashing the teeth and doing hardball confrontations as an assistant principal, I started getting intrigued by conflict, and because it's really scary. Usually when the conflict happens, our main immediately downshifts into safety, and some people want to run from it. Some people, try to divert it. There's all kinds of ways to deal with conflict. And some people, go forward and just take a hammer and beat the heck out of people. So those are all options. But what I hope to do today in the short time we have together is give you a couple of real specific examples with a couple of references to follow up. And let me first say that I believe it's chapter 4, there are 10 strategies in the Tyrell book that we wrote about several years ago, and we will update that sometime in the future. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what would help solve conflict, and I have given up on that question. What I finally realized is this is not about solving conflict, it's trying to manage conflict effectively. You can't, as a teacher, as a principal, as a staff development person, as a central office, board member, whatever, you flat out cannot solve all conflict. You do not have enough staffing nor time to be able to handle every issue that comes forward. So sometimes the best you can do, and I started refocusing on how do I manage conflict constructively, because I don't believe that solving all conflict and having no creative tension in an organization is good either. Larry Cuban years ago at Stanford wrote an article on firefighting, and I think most principals, teachers, etc., are firefighters. We're constantly in a fire. We're trying to figure out how to put the fire out. And he said, certainly one of the strategies in education is how do you put fires out? But another one is how do you fireproof systems? In other words, do you have enough trust and collaboration built in the system so that you can fireproof your system a little bit so you're not always in conflict and in chaos? And then he said the third point, which I thought was pretty interesting. He said, as a leader, you also have a responsibility to start fires. Now, I think if we look at it, we want fires that are controllable so that we have some input and can direct them. But there are times when I don't want to start a fire under somebody if it's not working for kids or working for staff. Sometimes it is to start a fire, and if they can't stand the heat, maybe sometimes people do have to move on. So basically I work off of a continuum and teach other administrators this. On one side of the continuum, really to your right, is being the most open, coachable, friendly person that you can imagine. And on the left side of that continuum, as you look out, reversed, obviously, if you're looking toward a continuum. But on the other side of the continuum is basically, doggone it, do it this way and do it now, I'm going to kick your butt. And what I found out is that we need all the strategies in between that, trying to figure out how to motivate people, how to work collaboratively, and sometimes you have to do the end. So let me kind of step that off. At first, just, there may be a conflict or maybe things are not being done in instruction. And by the way, if we are only in conflict, I don't see how we ever focus on instruction and learning. And so that's one of the major premises, in my opinion, in managing conflict constructively, is that it saves time so that we can get on the instructional issues, which is what we're really being held accountable for and what most of us went into education for. So on one side of the continuum is, what are you working on? What's going to make it better? And you get some feedback. As you move over the continuum, give me two or three things that you want to work on, or what's causing you problems, or what's the conflict. Moving farther over, give me one thing. If there's one thing you could do better, that would help you spend more time on instruction and less time on conflict, what would it be? About midway, I start taking more of the responsibility and saying, here's one thing that I've noticed. Now, I'm in a supervisor capacity most of the time as a principal, but you can also do this as a coach. Here's one thing that I've noticed that you may want to work on. Now, I notice I'm being more directive at that point, not as much willing to take whatever they say. I'm going to be prescribing or giving them some suggestions. Farther over on the continuum, here is a plan. Here might be a workshop that will help you. Here's a mentor. Here is something that we got to work on to get better. Moving farther over is, here is your written plan. Bring your union rep, but we are going to get a handle on this. This cannot go on. I can't have you in open warfare or whatever it is. And then finally, on the last stage, is where are you going to be working next year, because I ain't going to be here. So, again, that might be one way you have to solve conflict. Hopefully, or unfortunately, a lot of administrators start with the hammer and kicking people's tail. And I certainly have experience with that, being a former coach and wrestler from Iowa. That I can play that side, but we want to make sure that we give people an open opportunity to solve it before you get to that point. The other thing about that is, if you are seen as fair and giving people options, then the rest of the staff a lot of times will say, okay, well, the person had a chance, he is fair, he is listening. At some point, you pull the plug, and because somebody's not going to be helpful for the school. Let me briefly talk a little bit about causes of conflict. Where does conflict come from? And I learned this from a guy named Bob Chadwick, who actually was an old forester and still lives in Terrebonne, Oregon. But it's been a fairly good organizer for me that here's five causes of conflict. One is change. Change causes conflict. I don't want to do it different. It takes more time, whatever it is, but change will cause conflict because you got to do something different. Matter of fact, if you may be holding the phone to your ear, but if you can do this, everybody just fold their arms for a minute. Fold their arms and notice which arm is on top. Now, refold your arms, and whatever is on top, put it on the bottom and put your bottom arm on top. My guess is everybody's going to feel that that's really uncomfortable, and change is uncomfortable. And yes, sometimes we need to know why the change is going to occur, but change will cause conflict because it means giving up at least part some of the things that we're comfortable doing, and it means we've got to do something different. One of the reasons I use the folded arm metaphor is, number one, it's kinesthetic, but number two, the question I usually ask is, if it's working for kids, keep doing it. But if we've got outliers, what I've found in the urban centers that where I've been principal is, you can use best practice, but you've always got some kids that are not going to learn through best practice. It is our job, in my opinion, to come up with multiple best practices and not just sit and say, well, they didn't do it, so therefore we can't teach them. That's not acceptable enough. Now, I also know we cannot force kids to learn, but what we do have responsibility is to open that up so that we have more accessible to more kids. Change will cause conflict, and if you're going to lead change, you might want to put on iron underwear because you're going to get attacked sometimes from all sides. And sometimes it's important to change because if it's not working, do something different. That is the bottom line, what I've learned in 38 years in public education. If it is not working, try something else. I don't know what else to say. The second thing that can cause conflict is a power differential. I always know as a principal, if I got 10 kids coming in, they see me as really powerful, that I can just wave my magic wand and have something happen. I also get that with parents. I love when they call and say, well, just tell the teachers what to do. And I kind of hit my head and go, God, why didn't I think of that? Jeez, that's just not the way organizations work. But when there is a power differential, sometimes that causes conflict. Who do they think they are? They can murder me around, blah, 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 blah. Well, most really wise administrators know that you're only going to get something done through the hard efforts of a lot of good intentioned and ethical people. It's not going to be by fiat. And maybe the fiat process worked 20, 30 years ago, but I have not seen it work very well. And that does not mean that the teacher or the principal or the central office person doesn't have some line of authority and some role in that. But at the same time, you're going to have to attract and generate possibilities for people to move forward. And sometimes the power conflict, when you sit down and confront somebody on something that you're not happy with, that's going to cause some conflict. And, you know, some people will go silent, go underground, and then try and basically, well, have you ever heard this? A staff saying, I was here before the last three principals, I'm going to be here after they're gone, too. And, in fact, sometimes they are. So power differentials can get you into conflict. Scarcity. Automatically, education is in conflict because you will never have enough money or staffing to do everything that's demanded and everything that is really needed for staff and students. But bottom line, scarcity, you are in with two numbers with staffing and budget. Everybody's feeding for the same trough. Peter Senge and others would call this tragedy of the commons. But bottom line, if math gets more, English gets less. And as a principal or as a teacher on the budget committee or as a central office person who has to make tough budget decisions, especially in this economy, it means somebody's going to get less. And anytime people are all going after the same issue or the same pot of money or the same resource, you're going to have conflict. So keep that in mind in education. We are in a scarcity mode. We never have enough, and you're always going to be in conflict over resources. Now, don't widen your thought of resources is more than just money. It is time. It is energy. It is good thinking, etc. So, but the scarcity mentality forces people to get into conflict because they get scared, or it's like I got to fight for every nickel that I get, and. And I will tell you, sometimes as a high school principal, it's like, well, screw the elementary. I'm going to get what I got because I'm here to support my high school. Well, I understand that. At the same time, you don't want elementary and middle school going down the tubes. And so it takes people to sometimes put aside their own individual needs for the good of the group. And the scarcity can put everybody into that, I'm going to get mine and the heck with everybody else. Fourth one is diversity. You know, the one that most people think about in terms of diversity is ethnicity or race, et cetera. I'm going to suggest that you widen that view, that diversity of cultures is certainly an area where conflict happens. In the inner city of Minneapolis, where I was principal, we had in a very short time about 15% Somali population move in. And when you have Somali population moving in and washing their feet in the sinks, that caused some problems. There were kids that were really upset with that, and cultural changes can really cause, you know, a lack of understanding can cause conflict. Now, that conflict can be a great source of learning about new cultures if handled right. But if it becomes they don't do like we do, that can, again, that gets you back into the diversity, almost a scarcity mentality. Here's another part of diversity that I think has to be on the table. If we cannot work in groups where we honor people's different viewpoints, one of the things that attracted me to Ruby's work back in 95 when I was principal, she said, quit scolding them and quit excusing them, teach them. And I said, I can work with this woman. I like to say, I don't care who they are. I literally grew up next to the tracks. So what? Does that mean I can't learn? If we cannot agree that diversity of thought, diversity of just people, I don't know how we're ever going to have the society that we want. So one of the questions I ask sometimes in a conflict workshop is, when you say you believe in diversity, Edward O. Wilson wrote a book called Diversity of Life, and he's in there, he says, diversity strengthens. I ask you, in the organizations and meetings that you attend, do you believe diversity strengthens? And if you say yes, then you tell me what I would see or what I would hear if I came to your meetings. And I would say, yes, diversity really is honored and strengthened in this organization. Or do we shoot people who come up with wild ideas? Tom Peterson once said that the chance of getting good ideas is inversely proportional to the chance of getting shot. So if we shoot people who have creative ideas, you're probably not going to get a lot of creative ideas because people tend to just be silent and say, well, the heck with that. I'm not going to put myself at risk. So one of the things of diversity I start with is, do we listen to each other? Do we listen to their point of view? Do we understand the mental models that they're working off of? And is there a part of what they're saying that can be helpful and be helpful to our organization and to our kids? Because bottom line, this is about kids, although we have to do it for staff if we want for kids. And finally, this moves into the last one, which is civility. And sometimes we just don't treat each other very well. And I think part of that is because we just, there are so many demands, so many things coming in from the outside that diversity or civility sometimes gets lost. And let me leave you with this quote on civility. St. Augustine said, "In essentials, we need unity. In non-essentials, we need flexibility. In everything, we need civility." So one of the things as a principal or as a leader, what I do is, if it is essential for running this school, if it's essential for running this department, if it's essential for running this grade level, if it's essential for running this area, the area superintendent, we better have unity on it. And quit trying to hold kids accountable for things that the staff will not hold each other accountable for. Knock it off. Because if we can't agree on what's essential, don't be laying it off on the kids. They won't pay. If we can't come to agreement, how many times have you sat in faculty meetings and we said, here's the faculty handbook for staff, for the kids, and everybody's going to agree to keep food out of the hallway and write passes, et cetera. And day two, people are running their own program. So if the staff cannot come to consensus on what's important to run that school, quit laying it off on the kids. We have to come together first if we're, I think, to make any real headway for that. So in non-essentials, ways of learning, we have pretty clear what we want kids to learn. But on how they're going to learn that, I think we need lots of flexibility. We need multiple best practices on how we're going to get there. But in everything, we are talking about humans. We need to be civil to each other. And so sometimes when somebody is not civil, then we have to figure out ways to confront that. And there are strategies to do that through fierce conversations, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Crucial conversations, there are multiple possibilities for that, but we'll talk more about some of those later. So I've been talking nonstop here for about 15 minutes, and what I want to do is just take about a 30-second break and ask you this question. If we stopped right now, we're not going to stop right now. If we stopped right now, what is one thing that has been either reconfirming what you already believed, one thing that might be a new aha for you, no pun intended, well, the pun is intended, or number three, where did Pig dig this guy up, and what was he smoking before he started this conference call? So take 30 seconds.
If anyone wants to email their comments and turn in a question at this point, we certainly welcome that.
About 10 seconds. Okay, let me give you a strategy that I think has been one of the most important, and it is in the book, and it comes from the resource called Influencing with Integrity by Jeannie Laborde. That's G-E-N-I-E, middle initial is Z, Laborde, L-A-B-O-R-D-E. And it was written back in the 80s, but it's one of the cleanest communication books that I've read. It's based on some neuro-linguistic programming. But these are auditory cues that I'm going to suggest that you listen for, and here's why. If you cannot get clarity of language, if you cannot define the problem, you can't solve it. Susan Scott, in her book, Fierce Conversations, which I will talk about a little bit later, really recommend that book. She said two things that, well, she said many things, but here's two things that really grabbed me. on page 70, not that it made a real impact on me, but on page 70, you'll see the quote, "I have never witnessed spontaneous recovery from incompetence." Now think about that. If we practice the Bo Peep style of leadership, leave them alone and they'll come home dragging their tail, well, that isn't my experience in 38 years. Leaving it alone usually means you're tacitly approving it and nobody's wading into a problem. If when I've done about four turnarounds, retired four times, done about four turnaround projects with schools, and invariably when I go into a new school, it's like, nobody can deal with Herman, you know, and I find out who is Herman. And sometimes what we find out is nobody has talked to or confronted or even had a conversation with Herman. That's just the way Herman is, and if you approach Herman, he'd bite your head off. Well, that's one way, and that, of course, keeps him safe. Do we have people who are willing to wade in and have those hard conversations? And sometimes what you find out is you'll find that there's really a creative person there, but he's just been doing it his way forever, and that's the way it is. Now, I also will admit to you, in my 38 years, there I did meet a one-time Herman that just flat-out refused to change. And within 2 years, I had built an in-school suspension program, and Herman became my in-school suspension teacher, to which he said, "You can't do that," to which I said, "I have right of assignment." And so that was not. Now, I will also tell you that Herman's son was on the school board. Those are not easy things to do. But bottom line, if kids are being hurt and things are not going to change and you've given opportunities for change and there's flat-out resistance, sometimes you do have to go to the far end of the continuum and take them out. However, most times what I've found is by sitting down and talking about what people want and what they're willing to contribute, you usually can get some movement, but also obviously, you've got the hammer that you can use, but we want to see if we can solve and manage conflicts with our skills rather than just brute force, because force long-term will not get it done. You cannot do everything through brute force. So, the second thing that Susan Scott said is that most people spend most of their time telling you about what they don't want. Now, I want you to start tracking your conversations in school and in life. How much time are you spending listening to people tell you what they do not want? Now, people want to tell their story. And to be a good relationship, you want to listen to some of their story. However, at some point, if you are going to be a facilitator of changing the way things are done, if you're going to be that catalyst to make things move, you're going to have to start talking about what you do want versus what you don't want. And that is a huge shift in terms of conflict management. Yes, listen to what they don't want. Yeah, those kids are tough to deal with. Yeah, the community doesn't support us. All those things are true. And what is it that we can do? Because with lack of efficacy, then everything is external. Until a person is going to take some responsibility for change, it's going to be a tough sled. Now, you can help them with that. But bottom line, you want to shift the conversation at some point. What is it you want? And some don't be surprised if the person just is totally has no idea. They have spent so many years talking about what they don't want and complaining about the board, the central office, the teacher, the principal, the kids, the parents, the whatever. Sometimes people spend most of their time blaming external causes and do not take it internally on what they can do. So when you can help someone define what it is they want, you increase the chance of getting there. Now, this is literally compatible with the brain because the brain is a working memory and consciousness. As long as it's not conscious, you can't mediate it. So no strategies that we have, if it's out of conscious, will help. You have got to help get them to define what it is they want. And once they can define that, and to the degree that they get it defined clearly, you increase their chance of getting there. If it's, "I just want kids to feel good," great. What will they be doing when the kids feel good? When they feel good, what will they be able to accomplish? I'm not going to leave it at feeling good. I want everybody to feel good too. Well, yippee. That's not enough. what does that mean? Give everything away? So you've got to help them define that. Here's a strategy. So really, conflict management is about helping someone define what they want versus what they got. So here is a strategy to help get clarity about what they want. Think about fuzzy nouns you hear on a regular basis. As I say, it's in the book. But fuzzy nouns. The kids don't come on time. The parents don't support the school. The administrators sit on their rear end in the offices. From this time forward, my request from you, I have no power to make this happen, but my request for you is, when you hear fuzzy nouns, assume there is fuzzy thinking going on. When you hear the kids won't come on time, your response is, which kids specifically are you talking about? More often than not, they'll say those three in the back or this one kid over here. In other words, it's not 30 kids. It's one kid. It's two kids. It's three kids. Now, if it's 30 kids, that's a problem that we got to deal with. But generally, what you want to do is define the problem. If it's two kids, that's a different problem than 30 kids. Fuzzy nouns. The administrators are never out here at all helping us. Which administrator specifically are you talking about? Well, it's that Summers guy. He's sitting on his rear end doing paperwork. He ought to be out here in the hall helping us with passing time. Well, let's go talk to Summers. Let's not hit Stevenson, Fig, and Tolley and blast all administrators. The teachers don't care about kids. I tell you, when I hear that from a parent, which teacher specifically are you talking about? And I'll talk about all if they respond to all of them. I'll talk about that in just a second. But generally, they'll say, well, Mr. Jones is mathematics, blah, 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 blah. All right, now I got that issue. What is it about Mr. Jones? What did he do or what did he say? Which leads me to the second fuzzy language cue is fuzzy verbs. Teachers are being mean to my daughter. Now, let me give you how I'll play this out. Because a parent will call, usually at 4:30, 5 o'clock at night, teachers are being mean to my daughter, which doesn't help me at all. That, what am I supposed to do, take on the whole school? So what I usually do is, so which teacher specifically? Well, it's Mr. Jones. When you say Mr. Jones, notice what I've done is I've cut from 150 teachers down to one teacher. When you say Mr. Jones is being mean to your daughter, what specifically is Mr. Jones doing or saying that is causing you to make the judgment he's being mean? Notice I'm not just leaving the term mean. I want to know what their definition is. I want to know the behavior that they're upset about. I want to know specifically what that teacher is doing or not doing. And if they can't tell me, they better find out, or I'm not going any farther. What am I supposed to do? Call Mr. Jones and say, I hear you being mean to Mrs. Smith's daughter. He's going to look at me like I'm an idiot. If we're going to confront conflict, we better get specific information about what the issue is. I'll give you a real-life example here in a minute. Another one is you'll hear people, I could never do that, or I wouldn't be able to do that, or nobody ever taught me to do that. Sometimes you'll get in, people make rules, and sometimes they'll say, what would happen if you did, what would happen if you didn't? Another one is the universal quantifier, where they say, everybody's got one. I love that. Everybody. Always. Never. And usually what I do is do intonation, exaggeration, exception. For example, my daughter one time says, everybody, I got to have a pair of guest jeans. I said, why? She says, everybody's got them. And I said, everybody? Because my first intervention was intonation. Everybody? Well, my daughter's tough. She said, yes, everybody. So I went to DEFCON 2, which is exaggeration. Everybody at Valley View Middle School has guest jeans. And my daughter is tough. And she said, yes, everybody. So I had to go to level 3, exception. Can you think of anybody, except you, at Valley View Middle School, who does not have guest jeans? At that point, she said, you know what I mean. And I said, yes, and I want you to know I know what you mean. In other words, it wasn't about everybody. She wanted guest jeans. Now, I grew up in Iowa, and I'm thinking pennies, $9.99. And I said, how much are they? She said, $65. When they revived me, I said, my contractor used to cover your rear end, not decorate it. Here's $20. Now, what did my daughter Temple do? Because she's pretty resourceful. She went to Mom, and Mom gave her the other $45. To which I said, what'd you give her the other $45 for she could have worked it on. Now, in the meantime, my daughter has $65 and she's out the door to go get guest jeans. Where is the conflict now? It is now with my wife and I. Just because you didn't have anything, you don't want her to have anything. You always give her the money. You never make her work for it. In other words, my wife now and I are fighting over guest jeans. And I'm going, what is this? I do this for a living. Who needs this at home? So this is how quickly conflict can shift when you try to resolve it and you try to manage it effectively, and then all of a sudden it gets shifted. This goes on in schools all the time. We're not going to allow food in the hallway. And what happens as an administrator? Day two, Harvey's letting them out with food in the hallway. Man, God, that's what I said earlier about if we can't come to agreement, we'll never hold the kids accountable. So let me give you a real-life example. 5:30 at night, South High School, I pick up the phone, and I hear the parents say, your school sucks. And I'm thinking, how do I get out of this one? I never learned this in administrator school. I'll admit you, maybe I didn't read that page in administrator school. Now, I'm being sarcastic because administrator schools, in my opinion, do not necessarily prepare us for what we end up dealing with. So on the phone, I said, the whole school? To which the person said, no, it's that math department. Well, now, keep in mind, I just got from 130 down to 13. So I tried it again. The whole math department sucks? No, it's that Mr. Lindquist guy. Now, Steve and I talked together in the 70s. He's a great teacher. So my next question was, what did Mr. Lindquist do or say that causes you to say that Mr. Lindquist sucks? And she said, Brian came home with an F in the geometry test. I now have a problem that I have a shot at solving. What am I supposed to do with the whole school sucking? Go out into the commons area and tell everybody to get on the bullhorn and say, stop sucking? I can't solve that. I've got to get a problem that I can define. I've got to get specifics. So I said, bring Brian in tomorrow. Mr. Lindquist, myself, you and Brian, and I will sit down. And in 5 minutes, Steve took Brian and they started working on the geometry test. That's an example of how we got to get to the real problem. We got to get specificity. Otherwise, you can't solve it. And people just stay angry and they keep ripping on people. So that's just another thing that I think is worthwhile. Again, let me, if there's a question on that, I'd be happy to deal with it. I haven't seen any questions necessarily come through yet. So let me just take a 30-second break here because I want to teach you. Give you one more specific strategy. When you walk away today, I want to give you at least have that one and another one before you walk away. So I'm going to shut up for 30 seconds and then I'm going to talk to you about fierce conversations. Peg, has any come in? Any questions come in?
The only question I have, which feel free to save it for when you get past your next strategy. The question that I have in front of me is, how is group conflict different from individual conflict?
Oh, great. Thank you.
I think all your strategies about specificity are terrific, and I see them working very well in individual conflict, as I think does our listener. So that's the question pending for when you have a chance to.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Sure.
10 more seconds. Okay, I'm going to address that question that Peg raised. How is individual conflict different with group conflict? The difference is the numbers. When you're in an individual situation, it's a little bit easier because you're only trying to get specificity with one person. In a group, sometimes people feed each other. So here, let me give you, before I talk about fierce conversations, let me deal with that group question. And here's the strategy again I learned from Bob Chadwick, and I'm going to give you about 5 different points here, or 6, so that you can maybe either follow along or use this in groups. Sometimes in groups, well, let me give you an example. I think that sometimes works better when you have a real example. I come into school, and there are issues with headphones. Some teachers are getting them, some are not, some are taking hats. It was just a mess. We had a handbook. I don't know, maybe 25-30% were not following it, just were exasperated. 2,000 kids in an inner city environment. And I, as much as I stood up and said, this is what the rules are, I didn't make them, but here's the rules, this is what we're operating off of, going around doing individual issues, trying to, gain consensus, it was a flaming mess. And what I realized is, if I can't get consensus about how we're going to hold people accountable, we're really in trouble, because it's really taking too much of our time. So here I literally did a staff development day. It was January, and I put 150 people in a circle in our high school cafeteria, and I counted them off by about 10, so I had 15 groups. And now this is a worst-case scenario, but this process will work with individuals as well as small groups, as well as large groups. I went around in each circle. We had a chart paper, and I said, put the issues on that chart paper that are holding us back from focusing more time on learning. What are the issues? And, of course, no adherence to rules, and kids are coming late, the usual suspects. All the issues. So now I've got the issues out on the table. Now I asked them to go around and said, what is the worst possible outcome if we don't solve this problem or if we can't manage it effectively? I'm serious. What's the worst outcome? Now, you can imagine what came out. Well, we'll continue to be in chaos. We won't feel safe in the school. Learning will still suffer. All those things came out. And I would go around the groups, and I mean, this took a whole day, so I'm facilitating the whole process. But I've done this in an hour and a half meetings after school and math department, etc. Now, the reason I asked what's the worst possible outcome is we got to get it on the table. Everybody's sitting on it anyway. They're sitting there. This sucks, and it's not getting any better. So I want it on the table. I want it written down on a chart paper. What's the worst possible outcome if we don't solve this problem? So, because those are their worst fears, and that's what people are operating on. That's what the teachers are worried about. Then I talked about if we are to make any headway, we have to talk about getting collaboration and consensus about what I agree. And then I went back to that St. Augustine quote I talked about. So, in other words, I kind of took a break from worst possible outcomes. So then we took a break. People got coffee and returned to their seats. Notice I did a kind of a shift. Because now the shift is from where we are, worst possible outcome. When we came back, here was the question. What's the best possible outcome if we address these issues? In other words, what do we want to see? I really was shifting it from where we are to what we want. So as a large group, now again, I've done this with departments. I've actually done it with a department of two teachers who hate each other's guts. Sometimes you have to use whatever you can. All right, so now I've got everybody working on what they want to see in terms of order, in terms of respect, and all those things. I want to write down the best possible outcome. What I'm basically doing is getting a goal statement. What do we want? Because as soon as Scott says we spend all of our time talking about what we don't want, we're never going to get anywhere. So I literally shifted it, facilitative-wise, shifted it to what... This is also in the book over a hockey story. Now, hockey in Minnesota is similar to football in Texas, basketball in Indiana. Got it? So there's a story about what I did with a hockey player who wanted to take the coach out, but actually they ended up not taking the coach out and we moved it. So what's the best possible outcome? What is it we want? Next question I ask is, what strategies and actions are you willing to take? In other words, what are you willing to do to make that best possible outcome come true? So I had to make a list of things that they were willing to do. Not that everybody had to do all of them, but I want to know what you're going to do. And I had the administrators in these teams as well. I had EAs, educational assistants. So I wanted a list of strategies. So the best possible outcome is your goal statement, what you want. Now I'm into an action plan. What are the strategies and actions that you're willing to take? Because if there's no plan, if there's no actions you're going to take, you're not going to do anything different. So you can imagine doing this in a math department or a fifth grade classroom or or a central office. I've done this with assistant superintendents and teachers already. So now I've got a goal. I've got some actions that they're willing to take. And now I ask them, what will be the evidence a month from now if we come back together? What will be the evidence that we're moving closer to the best possible outcome or farther away? Because you may not, if we're not doing it and we're moving, or we're even doing what we think will work and we're moving farther away, we need to know that. In other words, this is ongoing assessments. I wonder what will be the evidence that we're moving closer to our best possible outcome. I need to have formative assessments embedded. If I can't tell quick, I don't want to roll the dice and wait till April or May until the test scores come in. So I'm looking for specific evidence. What will I see or what will I hear that tells me we're moving closer? And then literally what I said was, in our departments, in our staff meeting a month from today, we're going to talk about what are we seeing that's moving us closer or not. Here's a list of things the teachers can do. Here's a list the math department agreed to. Here's a list the administrators agreed to. Here's what EAs. I literally put that out for everybody to see so that everybody's committed. Now, we talked to the whole group, so everybody reported these out. So it wasn't, we weren't hiding from anybody. But to make it transparent, I literally typed it up and sent it out that next Monday so that everybody got a copy. Did everybody read it? No. But guess what? This is what we decided, and this is what you're accountable for. Now, as a principal, then my job was to run around and see if people were doing what they said they were going to do. So that process, identify the issues. What's the worst possible outcome if we don't address this? What do we want? What's the best possible outcome? What are we willing to do, and how will we know, and when are we going to meet again to assess whether or not we're making progress? I've used that in terms of goals for the math department, EOL reading scores, two teachers in a media center. One was great, one sucked. I had to get some agreements on how they're going to treat each other. And, I'm just using in the media center with the two people. At the end of the year, one, I said, this is not working. One of you is going to bid out. And I looked at the person who's going to leave. So I did move to intimidation at that point. I had been meeting every other week for about 3 months and could not get people to the table. Couldn't get it to done. So nothing works all the time.
That is a great strategy. I've been writing madly because my husband's a member of some boards. I think that is a great strategy to take outside the school. It's a wonderful strategy. Thank you.
Absolutely. I've used it in just lots of different places, because otherwise you're sitting there and it just goes on and on and on. We never get a handle on anything.
Yeah.
So, well, I know we're getting down to the last 10 minutes. I would like to talk. I'll give you another fierce conversation on how to handle this, and then maybe we can wrap it up if there's any other questions. The last thing I wanted to talk about is that this is not in the book, but I would strongly recommend you read Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott. She's got a new book coming out, Fierce Leadership, in about, I did a review for the book. It's coming out, I think, September or October. But here's her 7-step process that I've used and I've coached principals to use with really hard conversations, like when a teacher actually grabbed a kid. And I've used this organizer, these 7 steps, when I was actually coaching someone. So it can be used anywhere in that continuum, from open coaching to hardball conversations. But it starts the process to get identifying what is the issue. And so and a couple of things that I mentioned are useful in this strategy. First conversation, she calls it middle rights. I'm not sure, because she talks about digging down to get to the real issue, but it's a 7-step process, and it starts kind of the way the Chadwick process starts. And here's how I will start it. Number one, what's the most pressing issue that we have to address at this time? Now, if it's an open coaching, I let them figure it out. If it's something that has been an incident and has to be addressed, I give them a chance to talk about it, but if they don't talk about it, then I'll bring it up. Well, here's the most pressing issue. You grabbed a kid in a classroom, and the parent is hot. To me, that's the most pressing issue right now that we're going to have to address. So I want to get what the most pressing issue sometimes I'll ask, if it's a coaching venue, I might say, what would be the most valuable conversation we have in the time that we have allotted? We've got a half hour, we've got 15 minutes, we've got an hour. What would be the most worthwhile for us to have? What would be the most worthwhile for us to talk about? Now, they'll give you a topic, but I guarantee it won't be specific enough. You'll remember what all the things I just said about fuzzy nouns, fuzzy verbs, universal quantifiers like everybody always. Those are strategies you want to use to clarify that issue. When you say the kids are off task, what specifically, other than looking at other kids' paper and not paying attention, what are other off-task behaviors? Well, they're talking to each other. Okay, sidelined conversations is another one. Let them identify. What specifically have you tried? You know, you want to get specific behaviors. Sometimes I'll say, so you want kids on task. So let's talk about how we get them on task. Notice I'm shifting to what you want versus what you don't want. You don't want them off task, which is a double negative. You can say, what is it you do want? You want them on task. What would that look like? So I'm trying to clarify that issue, and that's really the first two. What's the issue? And clarify it. Number three, what is the current impact right now because of this issue? What is happening with the staff? What's happening with the kids? What's happening with the parents? Whatever the issue is, number three is, what is happening right now that is making this a concern? I'll get things like, well, the kids are not understanding binomials, and I got to figure out a way to help them because they're not getting that, which means that they're not going to be ready for the test. In other words, I want to get it really clear on what is the current impact of whatever's happening right now. And if they can't tell you, then I am going to suggest it might not be the most pressing issue, or they're totally delusionary. They should be able to clarify the issue and tell you specifically what is the current impact and what's happening that they don't want to have happen, or what's not happening that they do want to have happen. The fourth strategy is, fourth question is, what are the future implications if nothing changes? In other words, if you don't do anything different, what's going to happen in the future? Now, usually what happens is they'll start talking about their fears of a future that is going to happen that they don't want. And keep in mind that people are having feelings in the present about something that's happened in the past about what they're worried about in the future. In other words, it's a time warp, but they're having feelings in the current right now. So I want them to start thinking about, if nothing changes, if this continues, what are the future implications? Because a lot of times, teachers and people in education, we're so busy with the current, we don't think about the future impact. And if we don't think about that, we tend not to want to change very often. So fourth is, what's the future hold, future implications, if nothing changes? Number five, and this is probably the toughest part of this, is how are you contributing to that? What is your contribution, or what part do you play in that? If the kids are not on task, what are some of the things that you are doing that, I know the kids have a piece of this, I also want to know, what do you see as your part of that? Now, here is where you listen for any degree of efficacy. If the person will flat out will not take any responsibility, you're going to have to be more directive and say, what part will you play? Because I don't care what the issue is, if you're in it, you have a piece of it. Here's one of the things I've said as a supervisor, to take my share of personal responsibility. I should have been talking to you about this in October. I got busy, and we're talking about in February. I'm taking personal and professional responsibility that I did not get on this early. I should have been having these conversations with you earlier. That's how I'm playing a part of this, and I apologize, and I want you to know that I am no longer going to look the other way or be too busy. I am going to be a part of solving this problem. So sometimes I have to do my own personal. What you want them to do is talk about how they, well, I guess I could, I've yelled at them, but I really have not put any consequences down. Oh, so you've had consequences, but you didn't follow through, so the kids don't believe you. See what I mean? What are some things that you've done? If they just flat out say, there's nothing I've done, it's all the kids, say, good, what time can I be there tomorrow? Because I want to see this in action. I want to make some observations. So, obviously, if they cannot do the self-reflection, then you're going to have to do an outside assessment. Now, you may have data that you can share and say, well, here's what I see as your piece of this, based on the data that I've gotten from parents, from kids, or whatever, or from your department head, or whoever. So sometimes you are sitting on data, and that's the time when you would play that. Number six is, what do you want? Here's what I want. What's the ideal outcome? If you had everything working, the stars were aligned, it was your lucky day, what is it you want? If they cannot describe what success looks like, I guarantee you they can't get there. In their mind, this is the working memory consciousness. If they cannot describe success, you will not be able to help them get there. They've got to have a picture of what they want, otherwise they will not make it there. And that's for a staff, that's for individuals, that's for me. If I don't have a clear picture as a principal of what I want the staff, the school, these kids to be doing, how will I ever lead that? How will I ever be responsible for my behavior that will contribute to getting to the best possible outcome? Okay? So you really have to spend some time on what you want. In the case of the teacher who grabbed the kid, the ideal outcome is you will not physically accost kids. Bottom, period. And this teacher, the principal I was coaching, this was the second time in 5 years. So we literally put a wobbly if clause. If this happens again, you're going to see a psychiatrist, and we're going to have a psychological workup. Now, this guy happened to be the union president. I don't give a rip. We're not going to physically accost kids here. And then number seven, what are you willing to do? What actions are you willing to take? And again, if they just file and say, well, there's nothing I'm going to do, but, you know, you control the kids, that's when I say, fine, I'll be in there tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I'm going to start doing observations because I have a professional responsibility to monitor what's happening in classrooms. And if this is out of control, this is what you're telling me is out of control. Or this is what I've heard from parents, or this is what I've heard from kids. Parents and kids want a safe environment. They want a safe classroom. So I don't buy it that kids want things out of control. That's not my experience. I've had too many surveys run with kids. They want a safe classroom. They want to know that the teacher's in control. So if I'm confronting a teacher, now, if I'm confronting something else, you know, there's all kinds of issues. But that's really the seven-step process of fierce conversations, and obviously if you read the book, you would get even more of that. So, anyway.
Well, Dr. Summers, I feel like we could talk a lot longer and get even more strategies, but we've committed to an hour today, and we really appreciate everything you've told us.
The following participants are in the conference. The number of unidentified participants
earlier,
is 31.
We have a special offer for those people who have joined the call, and it would be in two parts. If you would like to hear more about this information, share it with your colleagues, and call our office or contact our office to book a workshop. If you contact us today and hold the workshop before the end of the year, we will supply $350 of tightrope books with that workshop at no charge to you. And if you don't have time to call today, just send an email to the same address, questions@ahaprocess.com. And in order, just make your contact with us today in order to qualify for this offer. And again, the workshop would need to be held during 2009. And for those people who just may want books, we also want to thank you. And so for the next 24 hours on our web store, this is for today and tomorrow till 3 o'clock Central Time. I'm sorry, 3 o'clock Eastern Time. Using the special promo code of tightrope729 in our online store, our quantity price for the book will be discounted. Retail price is $22. Quantity price for five or more is usually $15, but For 24 hours, we will offer that quantity price for $13.50. So for five or more books, your price will be $13.50 plus shipping. And I've asked Amanda to go ahead and email the participants the details. So if you didn't understand any of what I've just said, it will be in your email. So that ends our call. It's exactly on the hour. So thank you again, Dr. Summers, and thank you all, Justin and Amanda, for helping us at the office. And thank you very much, all our participants. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.